welcome our next presenter, Blanche Collins from CDC, and she will be speaking about can webinars influence clinicians' intent to improve STD screening and treatment.
Good morning. So just a real quick look at our objectives before I start with the background. We do know that patients are being seen and treated for STIs in a variety of different clinical practice settings, including private care, private providers, and HMOs. And we do know through a variety of different studies, as well as looking at our CDC 2010 STD surveillance data, more and more STDs are being diagnosed in non-STD clinical settings. So just to give you some background, CDC releases STD treatment guidelines every few years, and the last set of guidelines was released on December 17th in 2010. And the guidelines are out there on the CDC website on an MMWR in the recommendation reports. But one of the things that we found is that a lot of private providers, non-STD, those who are not in STD clinics are not necessarily accessing or not necessarily aware of the current treatment guidelines. So how do we get that information out to them? And so a lot of strategizing was done at CDC, a lot of marketing was done at CDC, and we CDC worked with the prevention training centers, the clinical prevention training centers, on a series of trainings to reach private providers primarily, but others who see and treat people for STIs. And we do know that in-person trainings have really become a barrier for providers, very difficult for people to get out of the office, to travel in some cases. There are travel restrictions. So we worked with the prevention training centers to develop a series of webinars so that we could reach more providers with important information about the STD treatment guidelines. So what we did was conducted a series of three webinars. The first webinar was in January of 2011. Second webinar was in June of 2011. And third webinar was in November of 2011. Mm-hmm. We offered continuing education credits for all three of the webinars. And marketing was conducted for the webinars both before and after. One of the nice things that with webinars is that they can be archived and people can view them if they can't make it to the actual live event. So for each webinar, CDC, STD, clinical experts, as well as Prevention Training Center clinical experts were the presenters for the webinars. And we had three different webinars using three different webinar platforms. And I can talk offline about those and our experience with that. And then we also allowed participants to submit questions live during the webinar using the different webinar platforms polling or question function. And we're able to answer some of the questions, but not all of the questions, for each of the webinars or during each of the webinars, and I'll give you an idea of how many of those were asked during each webinar. And another commonality that between the three webinars is that we provided additional resources at the very end for clinicians specific to the webinar topic. We archived the webinars and the slides afterwards, and those are available on the STD Treatment Guidelines website as well as on the NNPTC website, both listed here. Since we were not able to tackle all of the questions during the webinar, we categorized the remaining questions and STD clinical experts with the PTCs and with CDC tackled those. And the question and answers are in the process of being translated to web pages and will eventually be posted online on the CDC treatment guidelines website. So just to give you an overview of the different webinars, the first webinar was an hour long, and this was just a general overview of the STD treatment guidelines focusing on primarily the changes between the 2006 and the 2010 guidelines. The California Prevention Training Center took the lead on logistics and planning for this. Our Cincinnati Prevention Training Center was responsible for continuing medical education. And with the adolescent webinar we conducted in June, we moved this webinar from an hour to an hour and a half, looking at some lessons learned. An hour just wasn't enough to tackle enough questions. The Sylvia Rattel Prevention Training Center took the lead in planning logistics with this webinar, and Denver Prevention Training Center took the lead on continuing education. And one of the nice things that we did with the second and third webinar is partner with professional associations. And in the case of the adolescent webinar, two or three of our speakers were associated with these professional associations. So they were not just experts in adolescent sexual health, but they were also association members. And with this membership, they also helped us market the webinar, both before and after. So that's the Society of Adolescent Medicine, Adolescent Health and Medicine, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. And our third webinar, we learned our lesson and kept it in an hour and a half. The Sylvia Rattel Prevention Training Center took the lead on planning and logistics for this, and CDC took the lead on continuing education. And with this webinar, we were able to offer more than just CME. And as you can see, we offered a variety of different continuing education credits. And in terms of professional associations, several of the speakers were members in professional associations, and the professional associations with the third webinar focused on correctional STIs in the correctional setting. We have several different professional associations that also helped us market. Of course, I'm going to, let's see, we have the American Correctional Association, the Academy of Correctional Health Professionals, the National Commission on Correctional Health Care, and the Society of Correctional Physicians. So this helped us reach more clinicians and draw them into the webinar. So just to give you a snapshot of the participants in the different webinars, we had on our first webinar close to 3,700 people who were interested and registered for this webinar. About 1,700 ended up showing up live on that day, with about 1,500 views after the fact. So the archive we're seeing now is almost exceeding the number of live participants. And then in terms of continuing medical education, a significant amount of individuals receive CME credit for that. In terms of our adolescent health webinar, we had 2,500 or close to 2,500 people register, about 1,500 once again, who attended the live webinar. And I said I would talk about questions. During the first webinar, we had 185 questions that were submitted live, and about 150 of those were really content related. We had some people asking for information on CME, access to PowerPoint slides, a few people who had technical difficulties. And so with the sexual health webinar, very similar pattern, 222 questions, close to half of those were really content related. And with the correctional health webinar, we had 27 questions and 14 of those were content related. And as you see, the numbers declined between the adolescent sexual health and the correctional webinar. But we really expected that because of the target audience being very, very small in scope in terms of healthcare providers that see people in correctional settings. And so each of the webinars offered continuing medical education, and as part of that, individuals had to complete an online evaluation. You can see the numbers of individuals who completed the evaluation. One of the nice things about the evaluation is that we got a sense of who attended. And in some cases, in the correctional setting, about a quarter of individuals who attended were worked in healthcare settings, and then with the other, the introduction STD treatment guidelines webinar, we had about half who were working in health department settings. The majority of participants were clinicians, and that was good because that was obviously our target audience. And then within each of the evaluations, we asked questions about the participants' intent to change or use the information that they gained during the webinar about the treatment guidelines. And the first webinar, a large majority of individuals intended to use the information. With the focus on adolescent sexual health, we had about 55% who intended to change based on the webinar. But a caveat with that, about 30% of the individuals who answered that question said that there was no need to change, so they were already following the appropriate guidelines. And then with the correctional settings, close to 90% intended to use the information. We learned a lot about webinars and what to do and what not to do. And one of the things that we did learn, taking a look at anywhere from a quarter to half of the providers being health department workers, we're really having challenges reaching private providers. So our next task is really, how do we do that? And by reaching out to additional professional associations, we're hoping to get more providers into our webinars. Another very important lesson learned is that it's very important to conduct dry runs. You get to work out a lot of kinks, see what system is working. These speakers get to become a little bit more familiar with the webinar platforms and how they work and how the slides are going to work. So those are really crucial. Another very important lesson we learned is you get a huge dropout rate. Our dropout rate was close to 50% with the 50 or 60% with the first webinar, and around 40 or so with the second or third, and that was actually a pretty good rate of attendance. Taking a look at other free live webinars, you see anywhere from 30 to 40% attendance rate. So we had a really interested population, and we did have a fair amount of people attend. But in terms of planning, oftentimes you're paying for the number of people who register, so that's something to take into account if you're going to be doing a webinar. Not everyone is going to show up. For the first webinar, we collected a lot of information with our registration, about 2 pages worth of information, and with only 50 or 60% of people showing up, that information was useless. So what we learned for the second and third webinar was streamline the registration process, collect only very important information. And then in terms of continuing education and reporting, it's very difficult for us to compare our live versus archive numbers, and I can talk a little offline with some of you about that, but because we use different CME providers, some providers count CME for the entire calendar year, and that was true with our first, and we couldn't distinguish between live and archived. And then the other two count live CMEs for the first 30 days following the webinar. So it's a little difficult to compare, and that was one of the challenges. One of the things that we can do theoretically is ask on the evaluation if they watched it live versus archived, if we really wanted to know the difference between live and archived viewers. Another thing we learned, especially with the first webinar, since registration was cut off because we had so many people register, people were watching in groups, small groups in some settings, large groups in others. So it was very difficult to determine audience size, and what we did with the second and third webinar was incorporate a polling question to see how many people were watching with individuals. So were they watching alone with one, two, three, four, five different people? So that gave us a better sense. We didn't experience a lot of technical difficulties, which was really great. We expected to, but very, very few, and some had to do with audio. Webinar length is very important. We learned the first webinar, we were stuck. We're going to do it in an hour. It's going to be enough time. And feedback really showed us we needed more time, especially since we didn't get to answer as many questions and answers as we liked. Interactivity was important. Other than answering and asking questions during the first webinar, we didn't have any interaction with the participants. The second and third webinar, we introduced polling questions, asking them what practice setting they were in, introducing case scenarios, asking them what types of treatment they would be providing for different STDs. And the third webinar, we actually incorporated a pre- and post-test, pre-test with registration, post-test with evaluation, and that will allow us to see if there were changes in knowledge. And one of the true lessons that we've learned, archiving questions and answers has taken an awful long time, especially with 150 needing to go out to different subject matter experts to answer that questions and go through a clearance process and go through an editor and get it up online. So commit to answering salient questions if you're going to do something like this, rather than answering all questions. So in conclusion, webinars really can reach large numbers of providers, and they really can be a valuable way to disseminate STD treatment guidelines. And the clinicians participating in such webinars may be more likely, as some of their self-reported data indicate, to better manage patients at risk for STDs. And obviously those patients would then benefit. We've got a fourth webinar coming up, focusing on men who have sex with men. The details will be posted on the CDC STD treatment guidelines, and we're shooting to kick that one off in June.
So we have time for maybe one or two questions.
Can you
make your way to the mic?
Do you think I really need to?
It's being recorded for posterity.
Yeah. Okay. As long as I don't see it on YouTube. Wiley Jenkins, SIU School of Medicine. Fascinating presentation. I do have a couple questions all in the same vein. One, it seems like your actual participants may likely be biased to those who already have an interest in STDs, so looking
Absolutely.
At your dropout rate and that type of thing. And I'm also seeing that you're reporting intent to change practice rather mm-hmm. than actual. So I'm wondering, A, is there any preliminary data suggesting that mm-hmm. practices have actually changed? And kind of to go along with that, is there a sense that maybe you've already kind of reached the low-hanging fruit with this one? Is there going to be an incremental benefit with the efforts required to reach those who aren't as interested in STDs? So for instance, you know, will webinars be effective in reaching those who you have to work harder to reach to begin with?
Yeah.
You know, how effective is this really in instigating change, I guess?
Very good questions. This is not our only method of training. Our prevention training centers do offer a wide variety of in-person and online and other webinar-related training. In terms of continuing medical education data, mixed studies show intent to change and change. One of the things we have not done in our evaluations is do a six-month or a three-month evaluation to ask them if, in fact, they have changed. That's something that we can entertain. I think it's a valuable thing to consider, but we have not done it at this time.